Hey everybody, welcome back to the MMA Vivisection with me, Zane Simon, and my co-host, Connor Rebush. We're here once again talking about this week's UFC card going down at the Boardwalk Hall in Atlantic City, New Jersey, headlined by a woman's flyweight fight between Erin Blanchfield and Manon Fiore. And get the little roll of the tongue in there just to make sure I don't pronounce it actually right.
We're trilling the R now.
Yeah.
That's not French.
Yeah. I can't actually be right. Just it would be wrong.
Fiore.
Manon Fiore. Fiore.
I actually did the exact same thing on Heavy Hands this week when I was like gearing myself up because I mentioned the big sumo news.
Mm-hmm.
That I was going to be talking about it on my Patreon, and I geared myself up so hard to say Rikishi that I rolled the R. Rikishi. That's not.
Yeah. What do you? What's her name? Screaming Pride Lady.
Yeah.
She would always do that.
Yeah, that was her style. It's not how Japanese people do R's.
No.
It's practically a D sound for them. That's all.
All right. Anyway,
I forgive you for Fiore.
We're talking about a mixed bag of prelims. They're fight night prelims. They don't have to be great. There are some actually cool fights on here, though.
Yeah, there's some good stuff.
Mixed in with some stuff that's just filler. Featured prelim is a fight I rather like.
Mm-hmm.
Was supposed to be Nate Landwehr, Pat Sabatini, which I actually like less. I am less interested in that because it would either be Pat Sabatini laying on Nate Landwehr a bunch, which is the likely outcome in submitting him, or Nate Landwehr overwhelming Pat Sabatini on the feet. But Nate Landwehr, Jamal Emmers, is a secret barn burner because Jamal Emmers may very well be... He's in top five for most underrated fighters in the UFC, I would say. Just because he is literally a fighter nobody thinks of at all.
Yeah, that's fair.
He and flyweight Bruno Silva and like...
That's a good shout.
Yeah. And trying to think who's another guy that just is actually really good and tough to beat, but nobody thinks of at all. I mean... We're going to talk about Jacob Malkoon further down this card.
Mm-hmm. He's one of ours.
He's one of our dudes. And maybe Julio Arce. Arce had a little bit of hype for a moment.
Yeah, I mean, I was, of course, tempted to shout out Christian Rodriguez, but I feel like getting your first win over Raul Rosas instantly means you can't possibly be that underrated.
Yeah.
Because that was a lot of profile.
But a guy like Jamal Emmers, nobody thinks of Jamal Emmers at all. And
even though he's beaten several other guys that I feel like have more hype than him.
Mm-hmm.
And David Klein and David Onama, like, those are solid wins. Darren Elkins, that's a solid win, even if it's an ancient, big, decrepit Darren Elkins still.
Yeah.
Yet no one ever talks about Jamal Emmers.
Although you're looking at... Nate Landwehr's record.
Oh, excuse me. That's why I was confused and shocked that I didn't even remember it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nobody talks about Jamal Emmers, and he's a solid boxer, solid wrestler. I think it's because he's very matchup dependent in how impressive he looks.
Yeah. I mean,
which is why this looks like a pretty cool fight.
Yeah. One of the big things I've always said is that Emmers, he started with the wrestling background. And wrestling really was the thing that he was best at for a long time.
Yeah.
But he wanted to box. That's all he wanted to do. And it's what he's been doing for years now as an MMA fighter. And his boxing game is now actually really pretty good. But for a long time, he just had a boxing game that was like, had some volume, he was willing to go for it, and every now and then he'd fall back on his wrestling and you'd be like, oh wow, you can do that really pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't ever lean on it, and because you want to be a real slick boxer, sometimes he can just kind of wait himself into a passive fight.
Yep.
but the better he's got lately, the more he's just looked like a really hard guy to beat. I mean, he got heel hooked by Pat Sabatini, but otherwise you're really just looking at a very close, I thought he might have won, split decision loss to Jack Jenkins.
Mm-hmm.
And a very close, I thought he might have won, split decision loss to Giga Chikadze.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And then he
incredible fight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, he's just a good fighter. And he's never going to be on anybody's radar, I don't think. He's never going to be in the top 15 or anything. But
if he could beat Nate Landwehr, you know.
Yeah,
he's reasonably one somewhat notable win away from the trouble is like both the guys he's fought who do have profile, he just narrowly lost to them.
Yeah.
So he ends up becoming a forgotten fight on the records of more famous fighters.
Yeah.
But all it takes is one of those to actually be a win, even not a very pretty one, to have some name recognition. Yeah, I kind of thought he won that fight with Jack Jenkins, too.
Yeah.
He certainly had to cope with a bunch of leg kicks and body kicks, but he also landed a ton of sharp, straight punches right on Jack Jenkins' face, and he also out-wrestled him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, ended up in a bad spot, won the scramble, controlled him on the ground, got some work done there. He's a very credible fighter.
Yeah.
And here in Nate Landwehr, he has a reckless maniac to fight.
Yeah, a reckless maniac who was a bit checked against Dan Ige, I will say.
That's true, until late.
Until late, yeah.
And he really just unveiled. But that is often the thing with Nate Landwehr. He is, because we talked about this when he first came to the UFC.
Yeah.
He sometimes seems like he wants to be a counterpuncher.
He wants to be a slick fighter.
Yeah.
And then he gets punished to the point that he's just like, okay, fine. Going nuts. That's it. Yeah,
he's sort of a souped up version of who's a barking like a dog man who just got cut.
Oh, man.
Months ago. For Mike Breeden.
Yeah, Mike Breeden. Yeah.
He's like a souped up Mike Breeden.
Mm-hmm.
Where Breeden also wanted to be slick and had all kinds of cool ideas of the fight he was going to have, and then he would get his ass kicked. I would describe these as, fuck it, fighters.
Yeah.
Nate Landwehr reaches a point against any quality opponent where he has to say, fuck it, and brawl.
Mm-hmm.
And he's pretty good at it.
Yeah.
You know, you almost kind of wonder why he doesn't sort of wear it on his sleeve more as his primary game plan.
Well, I think the big thing is he used to, and it's that whole, like, you've had experience, you've been around a lot. And a lot of fighters over time, they just are like, okay, I'm going to settle down and become a more technical fighter.
Yeah.
That is the goal that a lot of fighters have, is they want to feel and show that they have improved.
Yeah.
In a marked way, not just in a, I'm more comfortable in the cage and I don't gas myself out anymore, but in a, like, I have learned technique.
Yeah.
Way. And
I mean, he's been like that in quite a few of his UFC fights, even before the Dan Ige one, right? Like,
yeah.
As I recall, now that I know who the hell I'm talking about, even in the Darren Elkins fight, he was like kind of getting outboxed by Darren Elkins at points because he just wasn't really pushing. He was just having sort of a kickboxing match with him.
Yeah.
He's not that good in a kickboxing match because his defense is really, really simple. He just has to like shell up and hunker down.
Mm-hmm.
So there's tons of opportunities when he is thinking defensively. There's tons of opportunities for anybody to grab a little piece of initiative and build something on him.
Yeah, I kind of feel like when Nate Landwehr is thinking, he's not fighting.
Yeah.
Basically,
he just has to get drawn to the point where he doesn't give a shit anymore. Where he's having fun when he does it. I mean, that's the thing.
Yeah. Like,
It's weird that, again, that he has to be persuaded to get to that point because he likes it. Clearly, like, that's what it looks like when Nate Landwehr is having fun in the cage, is he is just testing you, just pitting his manliness against yours.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, he did that against Dan Ige too. He got just really, really outboxed, and then by the end of the fight was really forcing a lot more exchanges, and it got kind of hairy for Dan. So I think both of those will be pretty interesting fights here. Both of those Nate Landwehr fights. Like I said, Emmer is a bit matchup dependent. Probably going to let whatever opponent have at least a portion of the fight they want to have. And I think he'll be quite happy to have the slower Nate Landwehr fight.
Yeah, that is definitely the fight. Emmer's wants is a boxing match from the edge of the pocket. Yeah. That is his ideal fight.
And I think he's a better jabber.
Mm-hmm.
Better straight puncher in general. Smoother, faster. I also think he's just more apt to give ground.
Yeah, no question.
And will probably, just as he did against Jack Jenkins, have to struggle through quite a lot of kicking output as a result of that. But if it does reach the point where Nate Landwehr tries to go to war with him, I also think Jamal Emmers will respond in kind. Like, he's scrappy when he has to be.
No, he is just a really good fighter, honestly. Like, the fight Emmers wants to have is a pretty thin margins, low excitement factor fight, which is, I think, why he gets so overlooked.
Yeah.
Because that's the fight he wants to have. But the fight he's capable of having is a pretty hard go everywhere, really gutted out fight, battle.
Yeah.
That can be pretty fun. So
I'm kind of tempted to pick him, to be honest.
I'm going to pick Emmers. I think that the boxing is just too sharp. And if he can outbox Landwehr to the point that Landwehr really has to get going, I don't think that there's a guarantee that Landwehr can take over from there, because Landwehr isn't a great wrestler.
No.
And Emmers actually can fall back on that.
Yeah.
And I think that if Landwehr really starts to try to overpress and like get something going, that Landwehr can start taking him down.
How is Emmer's clinch game? Because that was sort of what Landwehr resorted to against Ige. When he just kept getting picked off at range and picked off on the way in. And he sort of somewhat turned it around by getting into double collar ties and landing elbows and short punches and knees.
I'm drawing a blank.
I can't really think of any good examples of somebody having tested Emmers there.
It's just not where he wants to fight. So
right.
He doesn't, that, and that might mean that it is a turning point for Landwehr. So,
I mean, he was clearly confused about how to find consistent range on Danny Gase. He's like, I'd better grab him.
Mm-hmm.
Then again, if Emmers is willing to wrestle, could just be a window into his wrestling game.
Yeah.
Yeah, I find myself quite tempted to pick Emmers. I just think Landwehr, sort of like how I picked Namajunas Hibas, like, I think just being pretty aggressive, but super hittable. and I think possibly, at least for a portion of the fight, more so than Hibas was last weekend, more prone to getting slowed down by how hittable you are.
Mm-hmm.
Like until you reach his limit break, you can just like repeatedly freeze Landwehr's momentum and initiative by stabbing him in the face.
Yeah, he's really not comfortable in the kind of fight that he's trying to force himself to have.
Yeah. So yeah, but Emmers doesn't have Ige's power.
Nope.
I think he will end up having a very hard fight at some point with Landwehr.
Yeah. Emmers opened at -189. He's currently at -198. So gamblers are giving him love. And Landwehr opened at +167. Is currently +175.
Hey, surprise.
Yeah.
Nice.
I like it. Emmers is, like I say, I think he's one of the most underrated fighters in the sport right now. Just a really solid, tough guy to beat that gets absolutely no love at all.
Mm-hmm.
All right, that brings us to a woman's strawweight bout, Verna Janjaroba, Lupita Godinez. And this is a great matchup and a really tough call, too, mm-hmm. honestly. Because,
although I have a gut feeling,
both women have games where they can be very dominant wrestlers And both women have games where they can be shut out of their wrestling entirely.
Yeah.
And when that happens to Godinez, lately, she's been finding ways to adjust around it and just stay busy as a striker and land hard shots and not get overly, not get the way she did against Jessica Penne and Luana Carolina, where she just kind of got desperate and couldn't find her range and tried to force only clinch exchanges against Calvillo and Ducote and Ricci. She didn't get takedowns really, but she was able to just stay busy.
Yeah.
And Janjaroba is a much more venomous grappler when she can get the fight down, but also a more anemic boxer when she can't. I think she probably throws harder, but it's all Janjaroba is a pure swinging cling artist.
Yes.
On the feet.
Yeah. Striking reminds me of he Brazilian with a Irish sounding name. Patrick. That's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah.
Alan Patrick.
Alan Patrick. Yeah.
Not
Irish Alan Patrick.
Alan. Yeah. Alan Patrick. Yeah, that kind of style. Hard punches, putting everything into them. Really,
just but it's all just the overhand it. With the idea that I'm going to grab a single leg after this, and if I don't get it, I'm just going to press you for a while, and if you return back to range, it'll be an overhand right back to a single leg.
Yeah,
that is how Janjaroba strikes. I think, in given that dynamic, I have to trust Godinez's counter wrestling to keep her standing. But she has had moments of Cynthia Calvillo-ing herself in the past.
Yeah.
Where it just does not feel like she knows how to pull the trigger and figure her game out when it's not all clicking perfectly. I think that's gone away, but it could come back. So I'm not feeling that confident on it. I just have to think between the, if neither woman is going to get to actually wrestle. And I think that could be the case because Godinez's wrestling takedowns she has a way bigger variety than Janjaroba. But she also will move away from that game a lot faster if it doesn't work. And Janjaroba is a great sweep artist. Few people ever, beyond like Carla Esparza, ever get to actually spend any time on top of Janjaroba.
Yeah.
So I don't really see Godinez getting to rely on her wrestling. But she's also been really impossibly tough to keep down herself. And so if neither woman is going to get to wrestle and grapple, then I just have to trust Godinez to throw more.
Yeah. You know, my gut feeling coming in was actually that I didn't really trust Godinez's takedown defense against... I mean, Janjaroba is, I think, pretty strong.
Yeah, she is.
And can be a really annoying wrestler, if not a particularly clean one.
Yeah, very annoying.
Clingy, just like a blanket.
Mm-hmm.
And just sort of my suspicion was Godinez's wrestling just hasn't really been tested by many very good wrestlers. And being all aggressive and letting her hands fly. But to be honest, I mean... Tabitha Ricci hit her with some pretty good shots.
Yeah, that's the thing. I was watching that fight again, just being like, yeah. You know, Ricci got really in on some takedowns.
She had some really well-timed level changes with some serious drive. And Godinez's hips held up.
Mm-hmm.
She really responded pretty quickly to all those. Now, those aren't necessarily the kinds of takedowns she'll have to deal with from Janjaroba. Not that Janjaroba won't shoot a double, but... again, we might get more just weird leg entanglement drag downs from the clinch and stuff like that. I mean, the other thing is, John Jadoba is, there's only one way to like be a jiu-jitsu fighter now and make it work. Well, I guess there's two ways. You can be insanely aggressive from your back.
Yep.
And maybe that'll work. Or you can be, I guess, insanely positionally aggressive from your back. John Jadoba is a pure enough jiu-jitsu fighter like Damian Maya that she actually can like start from a bad position and end up on top.
Yeah, no, like I said, she is a great sweeper.
Yeah.
Really great sweeper.
There aren't a lot of grappling first fighters, I feel like, in the current UFC who really like lean on a sweep game from their back.
Mm-hmm.
But it can be a very powerful tool to have. And if you're a real specialist, like again, like Damian Maya, that dude could miss on every shot he ever took and still end up on top of you. Because he had a sweep and a reshoot and a way of building back up and crunching into you and just bowling you over when you thought you had fully stopped the takedown. So I was just kind of concerned about that I think John Jadoba's stronger. I don't know.
It's tough.
It's tough.
I'm interested to see how it plays out because I have seen Godinez fade out of fights. Yeah. But I've also seen like Verna Jandiroba in her fight against Mackenzie Dern.
Yeah, yeah.
Where Dern just bullied her.
Yep.
Just she couldn't get in. She couldn't get a takedown, and then Dern just walked her down and out punched her. All fight.
Yeah, I think Dern is for a couple reasons, a more fearsome puncher than Godinez. Yeah. I think
she
hits harder. She also just like, again, she's one of those fighters who just doesn't give a shit that she's doing everything wrong.
Yeah.
So she just doesn't respect all of your footwork and your distance management, whatever. She just smashes through.
Mm-hmm.
Godinez is like actually trying to be a principled aggressive boxer.
Yeah.
She's trying to close with her jab and use feints and like keep this high guard up and catch shots and shoot back with counters. But I guess I'll take Godinez.
You don't have to.
No, I mean, if you have like pretty solid defensive wrestling, how exactly does Verna Jandiroba beat you?
Exactly.
That seems like a fair enough case to me.
That's my feeling. We'll find out. Like it is worth noting that like what Verna Jandiroba beat Angela Hill and Godinez lost to her.
Yeah.
But that I think really just speaks to the fact that like Godinez has ways that she can just kind of fade out of a fight when she can get outboxed.
Yeah.
And Jandiroba will just absolutely stick with what she's doing. And if she can make it work, she will make it work.
That stylistic purity helps sometimes. Yep. But
Yeah,
I don't think she's going to outbox Loopy.
I don't think so either. Odds on the fight. Jandiroba opened at plus 141, currently at plus 175. Godinez opened at minus 182. It is currently at minus 198.
It's within reason.
Yeah, I think it could be closer even. Just, I don't, you know. Both these women have ways to lose that I think their opponent could replicate.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not that confident either way, but I just don't. I think Godinez can stay on her feet. And if she can do that, then I have to lean in her direction.
Yep. Same.
All right. That brings us to a featherweight bout. Julio Arce, Herbert Burns. The featherweight experiment is truly over for Arce. It appears, or the bantamweight experiment. The
bantamweight experiment, I was going to say. Saying, look at those numbers.
Yeah, the bantamweight experiment is truly over for Arce. Never really an experiment that made any real sense for him.
No.
It's not like you're going to face weaker punchers at 135 pounds.
Yeah, exactly. I want to go down to the peaceful the peaceful realm of men's 135. Like, it is the most violent fucking division in the sport, basically.
Yeah.
And Julio Arce, as a well-rounded technician striker, really benefits from
being
speed over length.
Yeah.
Like, he can fight, he can be the superior distance fighter against bigger guys much more easily than he can be like the guy who enforces range against people who are just way faster than him and hit harder.
Yeah.
He just ended up looking kind of cumbersome.
Yeah. Montel Jackson being both all of those things at the same time was, in
fact, right?
Nightmare fuel matchup for Julio Arce.
Here's a bantamweight who's actually bigger than you.
And hits harder and is faster.
Yep. Always love when that happens.
Arce landed 20% of his strikes just being at the edge of range and being like,
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, he also ran into Song Yadong. You know, similar, not quite as big as Montel Jackson, but like, okay, here you go.
Yeah, it was not a kind set of fights.
No.
The fights he won, Andre Ewell, Daniel Santos, were good matchups then at the same time for Arce on any terms, but the ones he lost.
Seems like featherweight's just a more natural fit for his style.
Yeah, you don't need to be down at bantamweight, trust me.
Yeah. And I'm going to pick him here over Herbert Burns.
Yeah.
Who maybe can try to drag Arce down to the ground and hope, like, you know, pray to all the gods that he can submit him
before there's a very reasonable chance that Herbert Burns will immediately transition to a back take.
Yeah, yeah.
Or pull guard and slap on a triangle right away.
Yep.
Or hit a sweep into mount and jump on an arm triangle.
Yep.
Like, Burns is a frenetic, positionally deft grappler.
And he's venomous, man. When he gets into positions, he submits people fast.
But it's for a round.
Yeah.
Literally,
one round.
It is a desperation. I have put all of my eggs in the quick trigger grappling basket. And the moment I start to lose a step, like, even, it's not even just that, like, oh, and then, you know, he gets a little slower on his shots or whatever. But the moment his first few attacks don't work and he starts to get a little bit tired, all the confidence goes out of his game.
Yeah. Heart rate hits 120 and he's done.
Yeah. So Julio Arce has never been that dude, except one time he did get insta-subbed back on the regionals by Brian Kelleher.
Mm-hmm.
No, actually, it was actually round three submission. Tell a lie. It's 18 seconds. It was 18 seconds of round three. So that is the only submission loss on his career. And
yeah,
that's in round three. Herbert Burns is he's not going to win this fight in the third round.
Yeah.
Herbert Burns has, other than losing two decisions to grapplers and beating a couple of tiny, tiny guys over in one, he has never otherwise seen a round three.
He's been to round two once in a fight that he didn't lose.
Yeah.
Otherwise, if it goes to round two, he loses, whether by decision or against this level of finisher. Not that Arce is the same level of violent as Daniel Pineda and Bill Algeo, but he just gets crushed.
Yeah.
So yeah, even if Arce can't finish him, if Herbert Burns gets gassed and starts sort of flat-footedly stumbling around the cage, Arce can definitely just pick him apart, and it would be quite likely that he can finish him too. Like,
yeah, I mean,
what happens? Rosa doesn't get knocked out in round three, but he did by Julio Arce.
Yeah, I mean, what happened to Burns against Algeo? Like,
yeah,
he had Algeo in all kinds of trouble. And then Algeo got free and was on top of him and just started nuking him
Yep.
from guard. because Burns is just so like exhausted through panic.
Yep.
He can't, he just can't hold it together. All right. Odds on the fight. Arce is a big favorite. Opened at minus 556. Is currently minus 382. Burns opened at plus 377. Is currently a plus 314. Those are, in fact, the widest odds on this card.
Wow. I mean, I kind of get it. Yeah. Burns has been extremely uninspiring in his last two fights.
Yeah.
They have both followed the exact same fatalistic pattern.
Definitely. All right. That brings us to another men's featherweight fight. Connor Matthews, Dennis Bazookia, and this is a fight that honestly, like, Connor Matthews is another dude somewhat like Cedriquis Dumas.
Mm-hmm.
He's more technical, but he is a clear can crusher. It's weird too seeing him come out of the New England cartel like that, because that's a decent set of camps and training facilities and training partners. But you know, you look at you can go back over Matthews' record and opponents were 0-7, 1-8, 2-1, 15-97. And 1-2 before getting to the contender series, where he got wiped out by Francis Marshall, who, as we know, is pretty dogged, but not really technical anywhere.
Yeah, just aggressive.
Just aggressive. He came back and got a win over an 8-4 guy. And then a win over a 10-0 opponent on the contender series again to get in. But if you watch, especially that contender series fight, Matthews is a dude who, like, he's clearly been well schooled in what to do, but he, like, the can crushing more than anything seems like it's just really protected him. Either that, or there's just his coaches have seen something in the way his brain works and are like, no, you need bad fights. Because in like that Farias fight, like he'd go out there and you'd see him like throw a 1-2 and a low kick, or like get in on a waist cinch and start wrestling the guy and all that. You're like, oh, okay, yeah. Solid athlete, solid technique in there. And then he would just like stand right in front of his opponent trying to figure out what his next move would be. And he just got crushed and stumbled and hurt. And had to turn this into a complete dogfight because he just can't, like, he doesn't recognize any position where he might be in danger at all. And his brain isn't attuned to it. He doesn't seem to have a real good idea of range. Doesn't seem to have a good idea of defensive positioning, of movement, of like how to get out of the way of anything. His game is just all made for like people who go away when you hit them. And Bazookia, I mean, he's kind of falling into the same trap we saw of that. Who was that Greek fighter from the other week? Charalampos Grigoriou.
Mm.
They're both Saralongo.
I forget that name.
They're both Saralongo guys. And like, yeah, he's kind of a one shot at a time, aggressive power kickboxer, which comes with a lot of its own problems. He walks into range with his hands cocked and just gets hit. Bazookia. But it's not the same sort of defenselessness getting hit that Matthews has. It's much more of a like trained aggression and trained pressure. And otherwise he hits really hard and is willing to just kind of go in and go after somebody hammer and tongs. He just wants to get into the pocket to do it. I have to trust that over Matthews.
Yeah.
Matthews might be slick enough to land a 1-2 as Bazookia walks in on him, but if Bazookia fires a right hand, it's just going to hit Matthews really clean.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, you know, I seeing Matthews just like getting hurt early in that fight on the Contender Series really just drove home. Like he's just, he's not set for any of these shots he's taking. Bazookia may get hit a lot, but he's at least, you know, he thinks he knows what he's walking into. Emmer's just totally shocked him, but there's nothing I've seen in Matthews' game that looks like that.
Yeah, Matthews has a sort of Phil Hallsness.
Yeah,
to his striking in the pocket or even just on the edge of range.
That's why I say I think it could also just be something his team has just seen of like, you don't have, like they protected him because he doesn't have a defensive awareness.
You can't tell when you're about to get hit for some reason.
Yeah. Could be.
Yeah. He does just have a thing where he will just, I mean, I think it's once he decides to throw, he can't adjust. Cause it's not like, he is like fated to just walk up, and eat a shot no matter what. Like Phil Halls was the same. Like,
yeah. He could Phil be Halls, really slick when he's
thinking defensively and he's moving around and testing the distance still. And then you fire out a feeler and he'll pull back or slip it or whatever. But once he has it in his head, he's going to hit you, that he's going to like use this defensive read he thinks he's got, just fire four punches and three of them will land.
Yeah.
Because he gets frozen in place by the first shot that hits him frequently and then just keeps eating punches without adjusting his feet, without covering up.
Yeah.
It's a weird kind of, does not seem like a very good quality for any fighter to have.
No.
So yeah, I think I'll take Bazookia as well, largely for that. At least Bazookia seems to have some feel for boxing in the pocket.
Yeah. His game is underdeveloped, but it is a functional power puncher's game. Matthews' game is just like, just kind of feels like you're trying to paper over a fatal flaw here.
Yeah, and he really just has fought a ton of cans.
Yeah.
You know, not that that win over Yair or Jair Farias wasn't like impressive in its own way, because it was a really hard-nosed, gutsy performance.
Yeah.
But it didn't reveal in the process of anything good about how Matthews' game works against any resistance at all. And otherwise, this man literally fought a dude who was 15 and 97.
Yeah. All right. Odds on the fight. Bazookia is the favorite here. Opened at minus 123, currently minus 119. Matthews opened at plus 112, currently plus 108. That brings us to a light heavyweight bout, a light heavyweight rematch. No. In that UFC loves to run back fights nobody gives a goddamn about way. These two met in Brave CF.
Did they do that on purpose, you think? Or it just happens that they've fought before?
I think they did it on purpose. I think it was probably a fight that Aslan asked for and that Turkali accepted because he's terrible and needs a win. Mm-hmm. And he won it the first time. But, yeah. What are your thoughts? What do you got here?
I think that Ibo Aslan could be a good light heavyweight.
He could be. I agree.
I'm really not convinced that he is yet. He's, neither am I convinced that Anton Turkali is the guy at this point, despite having beaten him before.
Yeah.
To expose that, I think the version of Aslan that Turkali fought was much wilder. Because clearly he's a powerful striker.
The version that Turkali fought the first time did just beat Turkali's ass for 95% of that fight.
Yeah. But he went about it insanely. Like, there was notion of how to manage his own pace.
Yeah.
It appears to me that what Aslan has learned since then is what we're getting is the capital T technical version of Ibo Aslan.
Mm-hmm.
He simply does a lot less. And what that means is that there are a lot of ways for better fighters to slow his roll to the extent that he has one. Because really his defense is just taking five steps backwards.
Yeah.
So if you threaten him with something, he could just take five steps backwards. Now, if you chase him, I wouldn't say he's really a good counterpuncher, but he will throw more than one punch really, really hard at you as you come in. So it is dangerous to pursue, but easy to back him off.
Yeah.
Which leads to this feeling of things being really, really slow and indecisive until the opponent makes a critical mistake.
Fortunately for him.
It's the pleasure man.
It's the pleasure man.
Yeah. Like, literally, I think he lost to Tricali because it was him making the mistake of thinking Tricali was mortal.
Yeah.
When he is, in fact, a whimsical god of pain.
Yes.
He can't be killed. He is just doomed to live forever.
Like one of those Japanese demons that, like, cleans bathrooms or something. Like, utterly useless, but also immortal.
Yeah. One of those really just complete waste spirits they got over there.
Yeah.
It's Anton Tricali.
Yeah.
What do you mean the toilet isn't inhabited by an immortal spirit? Of course it is.
Of course.
Yeah. It's just a spirit that has to eat shit forever. So yeah, I think Ibo Aslan has matured to the extent that basically every too wild, too aggressive young MMA fighter does, and that should be enough for him not to, like, just beat himself again.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess fair enough for him asking for it. I would want that one back too.
Yeah, no kidding.
Just like, maybe I just won't beat him up quite so hard and I'll just win. And if it has to be a decision, it'll be a decision, but maybe I'll also nuke him because he sucks.
Since Tricali, it has to be said, the fact really has not changed at all that there is no part of MMA that he is good at.
Yeah.
His whole thing on the regionals was being ridiculously tough enough to the point that he could just have a sloppy, grindy, huggy fight with you that you would get tired having. Yep. And he would still be there.
Yep.
That was it. And in the UFC now, he's getting knocked out and submitted and those kinds of things.
And that really should have worked against Tyson Pedro, too.
It really should have.
Like, just still being there, that is how you beat Tyson Pedro. What happened? What went wrong?
Yeah, the thing is, the division is much more made for the Ibo Aslans, who... Yeah. Being a big, strong, powerful guy who does less, but is just has the ability to end a fight in any one moment,
mm-hmm.
that's enough to win a whole lot of light heavyweight fights.
I mean, look, Vitor Petrino, who's also fought Tricali, he was an insane version of himself in that fight, and he has now learned the same lesson as Ibo Aslan. His last fight sucked.
Yep.
Because he just didn't do anything.
And Aslan trains with Alexander Rakic. The king of being really powerful and doing nothing.
Doesn't that make sense?
Yep.
And these are two of a kind for sure.
So the sky's the limit. Heavyweight. I mean, he will, like, at that point, as long as he can string like four wins together at any one point, he'll fight for a title.
Yeah.
In that division.
Jamal Hill is currently rematching for the title. I mean,
right?
It's really not that distant a hope.
No. Odds on the fight. Tricali is the underdog. Opened at +103. Is currently at +111. Aslan opened at -114. Currently at -122. This is a rare case where I just think for a rematch, the odds should be really, really pretty firmly in the loser's favor. Mm-hmm. He beat Turkali pillar to post in that fight and then fell apart.
Yep.
It should not be a fight he loses twice. All right, that brings us to a woman's flyweight bout, Melissa Gatto, Victoria Dudakova.
Is Ibo Aslan the first Turk in the UFC, by the way?
I'm sure he's not the first, like, ethnic Turk.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
well, that depends on how you define as an ethnic Turk, because there's a lot of Turks out there.
Yeah.
Is he the first fighter from Turkey to be in the UFC? I just don't recall having seen the Turkish flag many times.
Let's see. Alptekin Özkılıç.
Ah, okay. How did I forget him?
Yeah.
Okay, well, at least he's got a cool nickname. The Last yep. Ottoman Ibo Aslan. It's pretty dope.
There's going to be a furniture joke in there somewhere. But...
The Last Ottoman. Yeah, if you're on my commentary, you know I am waiting for a chance to say, and the Last Ottoman is using Anton Turkali like a footstool.
Yeah.
You know I'm waiting to
yeah.
pop that one out.
All right. That brings us to Melissa Gatto, Victoria Dudakova, women's flyweight bout. And this is also a pretty tough fight to call. Mm-hmm. Gatto or Dudakova is a very undercooked. It's an undercooked, aggressive volume striker against an undercooked sniper counter puncher.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to tell which of those undercooked games is going to come out on top. Dudakova really falls in on her own range way too often. Will just punch herself into the clinch where it's clear that she does not have a very well-defined wrestling and grappling game or idea what to do if her opponent can really push her there. But she does stay aggressive and she does know how to bite down and keep pushing her game. You know, seems like she's in shape. Seems like she knows how to take the fight to her opponent. At the same time, Melissa Gatto really wants to be a rangy outfighter, fights behind a long 1-2 and low kicks, but is a little too low output and not hard to clinch up, and will also just use a good... She's really strong, but will end up just pushing someone against the fence without any real sense of any other offense that she's going to create out of that. Just kind of pure wall install. Dudakova is moving up to 125 pounds for the first time in potentially ever. Yeah, first time ever. So I am going to guess that Gatto will have the more natural strength, even though they're about the same size, actually. Mm-hmm. They're both 5'5". Dudakova's got a 67-inch reach. Gatto has a 69-inch reach. But I guess I feel like Gatto will be the more natural, stronger athlete there. And if they're going to fall into the clinch a bunch, I will trust her to just kind of control those clinches. And so take a really sticky fight. But that's about the end of my thoughts on it.
Yeah, I mean, that's about as good as I can do, too. I think I do think Gatto is pretty physically strong.
Mm-hmm.
She definitely has a real wiry strength. It was not altogether easy for Tracy Cortez to wrestle and grapple with her. She was just simply a much better technical wrestler.
Of course. She had that great comeback against Sahara Eubanks, who mm-hmm. like really bullied her early, but could not control her as the fight went on
mm-hmm.
and ended up getting body kicked really hard in the third round.
Yeah. I can definitely see Dudakova landing plenty of like little jabs and such, because mm-hmm. Gato is really square and wide open as she comes in. But I think that it's not just that Dudakova like falls in on her strikes. Like, I think she desperately wants to clinch. I don't think she likes the prospect of having to exchange with anyone. And you can see a lot of moments in her fights where she will like touch her opponent and then like duck her own head and barge into the clinch.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's a punch and clutch kind of thing, like, so that she can't get hit back. And I just don't really see tying up with Gato over and over again to be a very good idea. I don't know.
I mean, like I said, I think it'll end up being a really sticky fight where.
Oh, for sure.
We're talking like, oh, does 2 minutes of cage control, like, how does that stack up against five more landed significant strikes?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, Gato's, I don't think Gato's going to be turning down all of these clinches either.
Yeah, no, she's way too easy to back up and very willing to clinch without any real plan when she clinches. She just kind of puts her head into somebody and leans them on the cage.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, I think it'll probably be pretty gross to watch.
Yeah. Gato opened at -147, currently -160. Dudakova opened at +132, currently +143. That brings us to Andre Petroski versus Jacob Malkoon. And I love this fight.
Our boy, Jacob Malkoon.
Mm-hmm.
Continuing to defy the odds and God himself.
And hopefully be just only a little bit smarter, Jake. Only a little bit smarter.
Yeah.
You were absolutely owning Cody Brundage.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is like, he paid a much bigger cost for that one mistake than he would have against a lot of other opponents. That does not, that doesn't excuse him from committing the foul, which was, I, depending on how you view the word deliberate.
Yeah.
Like, maybe he didn't realize what he was doing was wrong, but he was intending to do the thing that was wrong.
Yeah, he set up an elbow to the back of the head and landed it.
Yeah. Yeah, the thing is I think, I mean, you know, I'm not casting aspersions on one of your other boys here, but I do think Cody Brundage did not like the way that fight was going and was like, yeah, that's good. I'll take that. You know, I thought
could be. I will always say if you don't want to lose by foul, then don't foul.
I 100% agree.
Yeah.
All I'm saying is that given that most of his opponents are fellow MMA fighters.
True.
There's a lot of dudes who would have eaten that foul and been like, it would be dishonorable for me to quit and go on fighting and just continue to lose the same fight. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, was a very solid performance from.
Yeah, he's dominating.
As they pretty much always are. He can lose solidly when he's just a little overwhelmed by somebody. But when he wins, it tends to be comprehensive.
I mean, if we're being real, and the fights that Jacob Malkoon, the kind of fight Jacob Malkoon wants to have,
mm-hmm.
the only fight he's really lost is that one, that knockout to Phil Haas.
Yeah, true.
He may have full well deserved to lose the fight to Brendan Allen that he lost, but he had exactly the kind of fight he wanted against Allen. He out-wrestled Allen all fight. He just didn't get a lot of other work done along the way. So, you know, there easy ways to beat Jacob Malkoon have not really come up yet, is what I'm saying.
I don't really recall the like comparative impact of their shots. But looking at the stats for that fight, if you were to judge a fight on paper, you might be kind of surprised that he lost it.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Is it like
he only got outstruck by 14 strikes, and he hit 7 takedowns to 2 for 7 minutes of control time.
Yeah.
Again, not saying that that's a way you should score the fight, but I see what you're saying as well. That like he
it was not a fight that Jacob Malcolm went out and had the fight he would have wanted to win that fight, and he just didn't win it.
Like, yeah, I mean, for a guy who we're constantly saying is like he's not very physically imposing or athletic, you got to say, like, he doesn't really get overwhelmed by many people.
I mean, one hell of a run to go for to 8 takedowns, to 6 takedowns, to 7 takedowns, to 9 takedowns, 4 back-to-back fights.
Yeah,
having more than 5 takedowns in a fight.
Yeah,
that is a lot of effective wrestling.
Man's got great conditioning, and he just has a really simple workmanlike methodical approach to fighting, which is that he will keep his jab on you. He has a great jab.
Yep.
And he will look to draw out a reaction from you, whether it's a counterpunch or an awkward backstep or something. That means he can use that jab to set up a takedown. And he will cycle through a few different takedown ideas to see which one works.
Yep.
Which fight was it that he... Was it...
Dobson.
Yeah, the one where he was really struggling to get him down with the double.
Yep.
He was like, okay, we'll try the single. And that worked. And it worked for the rest of the fight.
Yep.
It was six takedowns.
Yeah. And I honestly, like, just looking at those fights from Malcolm over his career, I'm not going to pick Andre Petroski here.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to.
Like, Petroski is notable for how well he can fight when he gets really tired, but he pretty much always gets really tired.
Yeah. The shocking thing is always that it doesn't really deteriorate him as much as his gasping red face would lead you to believe.
Yeah. He's carrying a ton of extra muscle, and he throws only the most stiff, awkward wooden strikes with all the power he can.
Yeah.
And it always makes him tired. And he's a very good grappler, but he almost lost to Gerald Meerschaert.
Mm-hmm.
And if Malcolm just goes in there and starts driving for a grappling match, I think he's going to wear Petroski out.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think he will probably do some decent outboxing of Petroski as well. Like,
yeah.
Petroski was getting, for long stretches, getting kind of picked apart by Meerschaert, who, if you want to talk about people lacking physical advantages.
Yeah.
Jacob Malcolm is not as slow as GM3.
No.
He's at least a much more naturally athletic mover,
mm-hmm.
And a lot more fluid. So I think he's probably going to get go. Now, this is worth pointing out. Do we know if Jacob Malcolm still uses his jab against southpaws?
I don't know.
Because as smart as he seems, he is an MMA fighter, buddy.
But even if his jab goes away against southpaws, I think he's going to make Petroski wrestle.
And, he will for sure. Yeah.
And if Petroski can't catch a sub on him, he caught, Nick Maximov to his credit, mm-hmm. but he's not like he's not a shoe-in. He couldn't submit Wellington Turman or Gerald Meerschaert. If he can't catch a sub, then Malcolm is just going to keep wrestling and keep making him wrestle and keep scrambling. Because that's the thing, too, with Malcolm is that even if you get the takedown on him, he's a really good scrambler and really good at creating and sweeping and keeping a scramble going.
Yeah, he's just a very well-rounded wrestler.
Yeah.
He wrestles on the mat like I don't know what his background is, but I assume he's got a collegiate wrestling background.
Well, I mean, he trains out of the same camp as Robert Whittaker.
Mm.
And I would assume that what we're seeing here is the
same wrestling team, perhaps.
I would assume what we're seeing here is the version of Gracie Jiu-Jitsu Smeaton Grange's sparring partner syndrome, which is Malcolm has trained himself to be the guy that fights Robert Whittaker in ways that Robert Whittaker thinks other people are going to try to fight him.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, yeah, we need you in a, we need Robert Whittaker to have somebody in the room with him that will just wrestle him relentlessly. Mm-hmm. You know,
hey, he does it pretty damn well.
He does.
Yeah, I'm taking Malkoon too. I just feel like Petrosky doesn't have any of the kind of slickness at range to not just have to wrestle with him whenever Malkoon basically wants to shoot. All I can say is I hope Malkoon also still has something resembling a striking game, because be a real shame to discover that this smart fighter I really like falls into the same trap as so many other MMA strikers.
Yeah. Yeah, apparently, no, he started at a, he started his martial arts career at a local boxing gym.
That makes sense.
At the age of 16 to shed some weight. Because he was a former rugby prop.
Ah, and I think everyone in Australia and New Zealand has a rugby background. It's the only sport they have, really.
Yep. But no, man, he is a very thoughtful, good game planning, good performing fighter.
Yeah, he's just solid.
Yep. Petrosky is an underdog here. Opened at +167, currently +200. Malkoon opened at -189, is currently at -229. That brings us to our final fight of the card. Angel Pacheco, Cowlin Loughran, and
he's back. The next Conor McGregor.
Oh, it is just kind of funny to watch all of these people go through their I want to be the next Conor McGregor phase without having any of the power that McGregor had.
Or the accent. That was the most important thing about
Conor McGregor. Yeah, that's right.
MMA fighters are just profoundly unoriginal people.
They really are. It has to be said.
There's now a string of them discovering that, like, you can just get a bunch of press by just saying, like, offensive, hateful shit at the post-fight press conferences.
Mm-hmm.
Work for Colby, work for Strickland. That's the move now.
Yep.
And I was saying the other day, like, they copied that shit the same way they copied Anderson Silva's front kick.
Yep.
Anderson lands the front kick. Everybody's out there trying it. Like, the calf kick becomes a thing. Everybody's out there doing it. Still, nobody's learned to defend it because nobody showed them how to do that yet.
Yeah.
Although a few have, but they haven't picked up on it.
Why aren't all you MMA fighters glomming onto Jan Blachowicz? Come on.
Yeah, come on. He's clearly the coolest dude in the world.
All right. So we've got Angel Pacheco here, Angel Pacheco, although he's American, so it's Angel.
Probably Angel.
Against, especially because he's from Minnesota.
Probably Angel.
It might even be Angle.
Anglo Pacheco.
Angle Pacheco.
Anglo-Saxon Pacheco.
Yeah. Oh, we got that nice Angle Pacheco over there, yeah?
One of your better accents, Zane.
Thank you.
It's not good, but it's
one of your better ones. No, not good. It's
one of your better ones, don't you know?
Don't you know? Got a nice hot dish and a double jab.
Wow, you must be. You sound like you're from the land of the lake, Zane. I could picture you now with a brandy old fashioned in your hand.
That's right. All right. Anyway, Pacheco,
you go to the supper. You want to go to the supper club with me later?
That's right. Go to the supper club in Lake Wobegon.
Oh, God. He's an NPR listener, folks. He is an NPR listener.
As a kid. Come on. Give me a break.
That's worse. You were a boring child. It's boring. It's for adults.
My parents had it on. Never mind.
This guy likes Beethoven. Well, as a kid.
No, it's not like I didn't say like, I said listen. Whatever.
You're a nerd, dude.
I am a nerd. Shut up. Angel Pacheco, Cowlin Loughran. Mm-hmm. And this is a hard fight to call for two very particular reasons.
Mm-hmm.
First, Pacheco is not an athlete.
Yeah.
And will not survive in the UFC at all. He is working very hard to be a good fighter. He's very Frank Camacho.
He's a lot of fun.
Hell of a lot of fun. Almost gets nuked in the opening minute of every fight because he is not durable and not fast and not strong. But he knows how to fight. Dude is like, he will sit in the pocket throwing combinations to the body and head, mixing elbows and hooks, going for jump, just like going whole hog.
Yeah, you want to talk about the habits of can crushers. Angel Pacheco's fought plenty of cans. He doesn't seem surprised or put off when the fighter hits him back, though.
No.
He has been training himself into being a very confident, aggressive combination puncher.
And Calhoun Loughran has all the physicality in the world, all of the attitude of a top-level pro.
Except for reach.
Yeah, he doesn't have reach. But all the physicality, all the attitude of a top-level pro fighter, and very, very little of the actual skill.
Yeah.
He is 90% bluster.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm being harsh. Maybe 70, 60.
He's a lot of bluster.
But it is so much walking forward, acting like you're about to land a really big hard shot, and then just diving in on a double leg that pushes your opponent to the cage and stalling out instead.
That is, you know, like how Conor McGregor fought.
Yeah. It's a huge amount of his game. He wrestles a lot, and he's not a great wrestler. And it worked okay on the UK regional scene, where guys also could not wrestle, and he was fighting people like 0-31 or 0-39 Will Carnes and 0-31 Reese Street. You know, eventually he moved up and fought some dudes in Cage Warriors that were pretty good. I'm not going to pretend that it's all like...
Mm-hmm. He had a reasonable progression for...
He won the Cage Warriors bantamweight title.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a game built on physicality and durability and the idea that you will just not be able to stand up to him being fit, being durable and strong. Because he's not chaining a lot behind that.
Yeah. I think the thing with having Taylor Lapillus be his introduction to the UFC, I mean, that is a particularly harsh reality check.
Yeah.
Because Lapillus has some slick in him.
And he's built his whole career around being the guy that if you walk in on him, he will be there to respond forever. He's one of the few fighters always comfortable fighting off their back foot.
Yeah. He is really like the anti-Colin Loughran.
Yeah.
That's like the type of guy he's designed to be.
Mm-hmm.
The difficulty, I think, for Angel Pacheco, for all that he does look like a much better combination puncher, and I really actually like the way that he uses his punches. His like boxing into clinch game actually kind of reminds me of Jens Pulver.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He really likes to punch his way into a collar tie and like land a hard elbow. And
yeah.
But it is a game that's going to make him pit physicality against physicality with Loughran over and over.
Yeah.
Unlike Taylor Lapillus, who is a better athlete than Pacheco, but also like he just like tried to keep Loughran out of a kind of fight where he could use his physicality and did it pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
That's the trouble, is I feel like Pacheco might have a good amount of success, but it feels like he might just destroy himself by like insisting on close to a much stronger man.
I will admit this was all building up to me picking Calhoun Loughran.
Oh yeah, like, sorry, I stepped on your exciting pick there.
No, that's it's fine. It wasn't an exciting build. It was just I was saying.
It was like listening to NPR.
Never gonna live that down.
as a kid, I just
got me. Look, you know, hey,
how kids do.
I listened to a lot of car talk too. All right, that's cool. Yeah,
kids liked that one. Kids did like. That's not the first time I've heard somebody say they listened to car talk as a kid.
But yeah, Pacheco. It's just I watch him fight and I'm like, man, you've got all the right ideas, and you're just doing it with the wrong frame.
Yeah.
You've just been handed a bum hand for what you want to do in life, where you look and fight like a, you know, average Joe who works really hard.
I just went to check. I was like, maybe he's in the back of my mind. I was like, maybe he's like 25 and he's going to bulk. He's 32 years old.
Yeah.
I don't think he's adding a lot of size, natural size to that frame at this point.
No. And Loughran is just, you know, he's an athleticism is cheating kind of kid where he's had an undercooked game for a long time and it gets him through most fights.
Yep.
Because he's physically strong and really durable.
Yep.
Really hard to hurt and really hard to
stop his game. He is pretty happy to take a shot to give two or three back. Like, they're not like well aimed shots, but he'll sling them.
Yep. So yeah, I just think he can force Pacheco onto his heels really easily. Pacheco is not really, if he gets momentum, he can insist on pressuring, but he can be pushed back really easily as well. He gives ground in a hurry.
Oh, breaking news, Zane, before we wrap this episode up. I'm hearing from the disgruntled commenters on this week's episode of Heavy Hands, many of whom are French. Alarming news. I have so many Frenchmen listening to my
podcast. I don't know that that says anything good about you.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't.
Yeah.
They're all saying it is pronounced Fioro.
Okay, thank you.
John Anik lied to us. He's wrong. Fioro. We can go back to the pronunciation that makes sense. Thank God.
I'll try to stick with like the Fioro thing.
Don't do that. Just say Furo. Come on, man. I'm trying to help you.
Yeah, I am beyond help.
Furo.
I will only drag you down if you try to help me. I am the like drowning.
Set that Tool song.
I am the drowning man where they tell you not to like jump in and try to save somebody who's drowning if you are not also an exceptionally strong swimmer.
Buddy, let me tell you something. I've been a lifeguard. You can trust me. I'll save you. Right. It's pronounced Furo. Right.
Anyway, yeah, I'm taking Loughran. Just athleticism's cheating. Sorry.
Yep, as always.
Pacheco opened at +238. He's currently at +299. Loughran opened at -278, and he's currently at -361. All right, that's going to wrap us up for this week. You can find me on Twitter at TheZaneZine, find Connor on Twitter at BoxingBush, find both of us over on the internet. I almost said the name which shall no longer be mentioned.
You can find us on the internet, though.
Yes, you can find us on the internet. You can find us both on Substack, frankly.
You can actually find me in the internet.
All right, we're done.
I'm watching you undress right now.
We'll see you next week for UFC Fight Night, Allen versus Curtis 2. Adios. Ooh.